you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hi, I'm Paco Romaine.
And I'm George Chen, and you're listening to SupDoc, a show where we talk to our interesting friends from the worlds of comedy, writing, TV, and film about their favorite documentaries.
And today's episode is the second installment in our Mayhem Month, where we spotlight only true crime documentaries.
Today, we sat down with comedian and podcaster Vince Mancini of Film Drunk and Up Rocks.
He chose Errol Morris's iconic documentary, The Thin Blue Line, which is considered by many critics to be among the greatest documentaries ever made.
And now, here's Vince.
Hey, everybody. We're here with Vince Mancini. Hi, Vince.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. And, of course, George is here.
Hello, Vince and Paco.
Hi, George. And we are trying something new today. We are recording this in three separate cities. It's a triple city extravaganza.
Even though Will's actually not even on mic, so it's just we need someone who knows how to run this shit.
Because we don't.
Vince is a podcaster. And have you been doing stand-up much lately?
I haven't been doing it a lot lately, but yeah, I'm still, I'm always like a half-ass stand-up.
In the game.
Yeah.
Isn't everyone a half-ass stand-up, really?
I mean, it's either you're either a half-ass stand-up or you're just like miserable going to like mics every night and stuff, you know?
Right.
I spend more time doing this now than I do doing any stand-up at this, honestly.
Yeah, because
in terms of hours.
This probably you like might have a chance to make money at.
Maybe. Actually,
it's paying for itself more than stand-up is.
Yeah, I mean,
Yeah, we just got a sponsor, too, so you never know.
Nice.
What's going to happen with that? Yeah, they're laying down some sponsorship for us.
I did want to bring up how Vince's podcast is tied into a huge fake news story.
I like how it went from just like a dumb joke that I think Justin probably assumed everybody would take as a dumb joke, and then now it's like, well, it's fake news. And it's like, well,
let's break down the genealogy of this whole meme that occurred, which is so Justin Halpern, who's a shit my dad says guy,
yeah,
right, and who did he have a sitcom with William Shatner for a minute?
He did, he did. Well, that was the shit my dad says sitcom, and then he had another sitcom with Chris Maloney called Surviving Jack, and
and
then now
was Emily Heller involved in that?
I think so. They're frequent collaborators. And then now he has Powerless, which is like the DC universe sitcom. But it's weird how like every show can't exist without being tied into a comic book universe somehow now.
Yeah. If you're going to pitch you just wear your Batman t-shirt to your pitch session.
And like I at some point you're going to be watching like Days of Our Lives and then they're going to have to talk about like Batman being off somewhere. Like, you know.
He's a great lover.
Or like the Lego movies, right? The Lego movies have totally gone off on that.
Yeah.
Actually, right before this I was watching Legion, which I'd never seen before. So I just watched the first one. But yeah, anyway, let's go back to Justin Halpern,
right?
Friend of your show, which is a Fraudcast.
Yeah, Fraudcast.
And you also Film Drunk is the parent company.
That's like my website that I write for. Well, it's part of UpRocks, so UpRocks is my employer.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Yeah.
And then so you have Film Drunk, and then you have what was the one you just mentioned?
The Fraudcast.
Yeah,
well, the Fraudcast is just sort of a thing, though. They're not UpRocks isn't really part of the Fraudcast, though I do post it on UpRocks. But yeah, it's that's just kind of a thing I've been doing for 4 years now, something like that.
Awesome. Yeah. So let's
Matt
get into
Lieb's frequent guest.
Matthew Lieb.
Yeah.
The darling of Of the Leibs?
Of the,
the very first of guest the Culver of City our very Leibs? First show.
He was. Mm-hmm. He was our the Sup Doc's first guest.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we talked about the Jinx. But yeah, so I don't know anything about this meme. Let's.
So, all right. Well, I guess I'll start at the beginning, which is not very long. So Justin Halpern was on my podcast, and he's telling this story. He's like, oh, I got a good Papa Roach story. And so, like, apparently, like, either in college or right after college, he was at this girl's house who he thought was his girlfriend at the time, and he was like, and at some point she's like, oh shit, my boyfriend's home. I didn't think he was coming home. And uh-oh. He was like, well, that's news to me. I didn't know she had a boyfriend. I thought I was her boyfriend. And he was like, well, I guess I'll just pretend to be asleep, because he was like on the couch, and like, and so he's waiting for the guy to come in. And the guy comes in, and he's like, and Justin's asleep, so he's just hearing this, you know, pretending to be asleep.
Yeah.
And the guy goes, oh, real nice, real fucking nice, and like starts crying, and then storms out of the apartment, like opens the door of his Jeep and like slams it shut. Turns it on, and then of course, and all I can hear is like the opening of "Cut My Life into Pieces," and then the guy drives off like blaring Papa Roach. So that was the story that he told. And then the other day, so like yesterday,
just yesterday,
yeah, right,
yeah.
So after the Paul Ryan vote, there was like the New York Times piece about it, and Justin had photoshopped the ending of it to say that he like slammed the door of his SUV and drove off blasting Papa Roach.
Yeah.
And people didn't like realize it was a joke or the origin of the joke, and so like people thought it was real.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's believable because he seems like a dude. Mm. Yeah, I remember in the 2012, when one of his speeches during the Republican convention is like, "I'm the new cool Republican who like likes rock and roll music," which was like AC/DC, which also was like not generationally appropriate either. Like that wouldn't really be your generation's like rock and roll music.
I mean,
and then he was like.
They've been talking about, like, they've been, like, Rush Limbaugh's been using, like, rock and roll, like, as his bumpers for, like, 20 years. Like, they tried to co-opt it, like, many, many years ago already.
Yeah. Well, they always get sued.
It's like boomer
too,
music.
In their campaigns. Like, they're always getting sued for using people's, like, oh, the Republicans.
Like, they only have a small choice of music that they can use without the artist getting angry, which is like Kid Rock and like Nickelback and like Three Doors Down.
Yeah.
People that would actually play the inaugurations and stuff. Mm-hmm.
It's like Dennis Miller needs to start a rock band or something so they can have some Republican tunes out there.
That sounds awful.
It does.
Dennis Miller's rock.
I don't want it to
happen.
He
could scat, maybe. Yeah.
Ugh. But if you want to talk about an easy way to make money, I mean, if you get into like right wing punditry or like right wing anything, I mean, like there's a limited amount of things that they can consume. And if you produce content, it's like you're automatically going to make money. Like Tommy Lahren.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Tommy Lahren as like the new like Katy Perry or something. Like, just vocoder, like just auto-tuned Tommy Lahren. That's what we're going to make. We'll make a dance track with auto-tuned Tommy Lahren. So this story did take off, and some people thought it was super real, or even if they didn't think it was real, they just thought it was funny. Mm-hmm. That was the thing with the popper.
Where was it? Like, what press picked it up?
Well, I know Mashable like had to write an article being like, "Oh, this isn't real," because I have the tweet because I responded to it, and it's like I'm weirdly like tangentially connected to it now, and so where is it? Sorry, it's got like probably 20,000 retweets at this point or something.
Holy
like
shit.
That. I don't know.
So it started on Twitter.
Yeah. That's oh yeah, awesome. it's got 18,000 retweets and 40,000 faves. So like. Yeah, it just sort of took off.
Jesus, that's awesome.
Yeah.
then Papa Roach responded.
That's the other really?
Thing. There's a response from Papa Roach. This is on AV Club. If you go to AV Club and you look up Papa Roach says, "When we feel defeated, we listen to Paul Ryan," and an upside down happy face. Which, if you, just as a reminder, by the time this airs, who knows what the fuck has happened, because everything changes day to day.
Yeah.
But this is a day that they realized they didn't have enough votes to even vote on the repeal of Obamacare. So it was like, it's nice when these things happen. You just see like cracks in the armor, you know.
Oh yeah.
Thankfully, there's some things. Well, and then Papa Roach follows it up with, "But seriously, Last Resort was about suicide. If anyone's feeling defeated, call this 1-800 help number."
That's good of them.
So they're trying to.
They also,
well, yeah, because they don't want Paul Ryan to commit suicide.
Right.
I guess.
No. And I would think because of the slumping sales of Papa Roach CDs, they probably need health care. You know, they probably need
CDs. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, they're cutting
no one has bought a CD from them in a long time.
The Papa Roach CDs that are accumulating and stuff.
I like how they had to school people on. Actually, this song was about suicide, as you'll hear from the lyrics. "And I'm contemplating suicide." Like, oh yeah, there's a lot of subtext to that one, Papa Roach.
It's hard to tell. It's hard to tell with those Papa Roach.
I didn't get lyrics. That the first time around. Yeah. So weird.
Yeah, it's like it's Leonard Cohen, Papa Roach, you know, up there in the lyricists of the world. But let's segue now, shall we, to this Thin Blue Line, which is considered by fucking everybody to be one of the top 10 best documentaries ever made, which is awesome. Which is awesome for Errol Morris and for all of us.
Yeah.
It started the true crime genre documentary series that has overwhelmed this world at this point.
Now, Vince, did you pick this one when we talked to you about doing the show?
Yeah, it was one of the ones I threw out. I think, I mean, it's like, it's kind of like the Jesus or Einstein answer in adaptation. It's like, oh yeah, that's the obvious
right
like, choice. Uh-huh. Yeah,
but you would be surprised how few people have actually brought up this doc to do, and or even Errol Morris docs.
Really?
Yeah, we've only done one other, Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control.
Okay, yeah, I like that one a lot. I saw the Rumsfeld one. I didn't think was that good, but I mean, he's usually pretty
unknown
strong.
Known or whatever it's called. Yeah. Yeah, that one's all right.
Like he was convinced that Rumsfeld's use of he was convinced that Rumsfeld had tied himself up in knots like because of his grasp of language. And I'm like, no, I think he's just kind of like a full of shit guy that uses like every tyrant uses vague language to describe the shit that they do. You know?
Don't make it to that level by being specific,
right?
On
exactly.
Anything.
That's why the CIA says like neutralize instead of assassinate. Like we've been. Yeah. I mean, like everybody's got every regime has their own set of bullshit terminology. This, you know.
Yeah. No, Donnie Rumsfeld, he didn't make it to that point by being a very specific dude.
No.
Now, he was scratching Nixon's back and shit. Like, him and Cheney were best buddies back in the Nixon administration.
It's weird. I mean, like, all of the bad things have somehow come from Nixon. Like, if you go back, I mean, like, Trump is basically a product of Roger Ailes, who was basically came from Nixon. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it always, it's weird how long that we've been stuck with that, with that group of people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hopefully they'll all die soon.
Yeah.
Thin Blue Line is incredible. Like, I remember seeing this in college. Like, I was such a huge Errol Morris fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw Vernon, Florida first. That was the first Errol Morris doc I saw. And I was like, what the fuck is up with this guy?
Yeah.
These are insane. There's something about Errol Morris, the way he frames people in the shot, that makes them look half carnival performer and half interviewee. There's something I can't grasp. I don't understand what it is, but watching Errol Morris documentary that he made last year and watch one that he made in 1988, and they have the same technique, the same feel to it.
I mean, he's so technical. Like, you can tell that everything... You can tell that a lot of craft goes into every, and at first, like, I hadn't watched this in a long time, and I rewatched it this morning, and at first I was like, oh, this is like so sort of overwrought and like over, it's like overdone, you know, but then like you watch it and you get used to it and you're like, oh man, he just does the shit out of everything.
Yeah. Like, well, he would make a great prosecutor. Like, he just keeps hammering home things. And this was like the first one where he gets... I love the way the flower opens in his stories, because like as he gets more evidence from people's tales, whether they're true or not, he presents them in his reenactments, and then he'll take that and he'll snowball to something else, and then the things just keep getting bigger and bigger. He's a wonderful storyteller.
There's like two things that are there's like one thing about this movie which is why it's so well regarded, which is like those formal things you're saying, like the recreations.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other aspect is that it's one of the first actual exoneration films that actually gets a guy off.
Yeah. And right? At first when I'm watching and it's got the close up of the gun and then the close up of the spilling milkshake.
Yeah,
I was like, this is too, it feels like too much. And it's probably inspired a lot of bad documentaries.
If you're the investigator assigned to the murder and you get frustrated with other witnesses, but when you got a police officer that witnessed it, you expect that they would know a little more than she knew. Procedure when it's a two-person unit. When either one approaches the car, the other positions itself to the right rear where they can watch all the activity in the car. And if the man on the left or the driver gets in trouble, well, the partner's in a position to help. Speculation was at the time that his partner was sitting in the car.
Hey, listeners, are you looking for a new source of documentaries? I know I am.
Well, guess what? There's an app for that. It's called GuideDoc.
Discover and watch the world's best hand-picked and award-winning docs from around the globe. A new must-see documentary each day.
Here's a doc I just found called Skatistan. It's about a nonprofit organization bringing skateboarding to kids in war-torn Kabul.
You can sign up through the app in the iTunes App Store and stream all GuideDoc movies for one low monthly subscription of just $4.99.
Go to GuideDoc.tv/SupDoc and enter your email address for a chance to get a free month of GuideDoc.
And now, back to SupDoc.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Vince, we often ask our guests like to pitch this movie to someone who's never seen it before. Like you're just telling a friend, well, like, why do you have to see Thin Blue Line? What would you say?
I would call it like the proto serial or the proto The Jinx. Like it's the origin of so many like true crime things that are huge now. I think this, I mean, I don't know if this was the first, but I think it's like the sort of high watermark birth of a lot of that whole genre, really.
Right. I mean, it's like, it's because it works as an aesthetic as well as actually solving a mystery.
Yeah, it's something
so
that
it's like kind of does both things.
Right. It works as a piece of entertainment, and it's also like probably a hallmark in advocacy journalism, because he got the guy off.
Absolutely.
Which doesn't, I mean, that guy's story is, that guy got screwed.
Randall Dale Adams?
Yeah. You know what
I mean? Yes.
Yeah. What I was reading, and I think this was maybe mentioned when we talked to Jesse Thorne, is I didn't really know so much about his background as a private investigator.
Jesse Thorne like was Moore's a private investigator?
That would be a very well-dressed private investigator. No, yes, Errol Morris, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
he was a for-hire private detective.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah. Before he
Do you know anyone who's done that?
I do.
Do you know anyone who's...
Of course I do.
You know a detective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course I do.
So what did he have a background in... Like, had he been a... Like, you don't usually just go straight to private investigator. Usually you're like a cop detective.
He
first,
went to
right?
film school. Like, he was a private... He wasn't a detective. He was a private investigator, so a dick for hire.
Right.
And then he, I guess he went to film school after that. But he had worked as a for hire investigator, yeah, previously.
I was talking to a comic that I think we all know this comic. I don't know if I want to blow up her job, but she was working for an investigation firm. And it was all like setting up video monitoring of people that it was basically workman's comp fraud. Mm-hmm, they were just trying to catch people on workman's comp fraud. Sounded real boring, actually.
Yeah.
Sounded like real tedious.
Any stakeout, like, it's going to be boring because you're just going to be sitting there for like 12 hours most of the time.
And it's watching people stretch after a run. Yeah. And you're like, so you fell off a ladder at work and right. at Home Depot, and now you're running.
Have you read the letter that Harvey Weinstein wrote Errol Morris telling him that he was born? Like, he heard Errol Morris on NPR, and he's like, hey, you're boring. I'm going to get an actor to play Errol Morris if you continue to be this boring while you're trying to promote this movie.
No, I haven't heard that.
If you look it up, it's like on, actually, I think you can find it in the references of the Thin Blue Line Wikipedia page.
Wow.
And there's the original letter that Harvey Weinstein wrote to Errol Morris telling him that he was doing a bad job promoting it because he was boring.
So when he would go on TV shows and stuff on the circuit to promote it, that he was like, you're fucking boring, dude.
Yeah, yeah. That's awesome. He thought Errol Morris was doing it was too dry, and he's like, here's how you need to sell this movie. It's got the, it's like a humorous In Cold Blood. It's a this and this, and you know,
it is like In Cold Blood.
Yeah.
Oh wow, I never actually put that two together.
Yeah,
yeah, it you is know, very In Cold Bloodish.
I'm actually reading this book by Peter Biskind called Down and Dirty Pictures. You guys know this book? It's kind of like doing like that Raging Bulls, Easy Riders, but it's like about the Sundance and Miramax in the late 80s, early 90s. Mm. And there is like one little paragraph I just noted the other day about how they promoted Thin Blue Line, because they wanted to basically convince people that it was like a fiction film.
Oh,
at least Miramax did. Yeah, that was their incentive, just to like try and get people to get butts in seats, you know?
I mean, documentary films have been fighting the boring stigma for years since they've started, basically. I know, like, Errol Morris was concerned that he didn't want to call this a documentary. He wanted it to be like a real-life detective story or something.
I mean, even In Cold Blood, he's like, oh, it's not, you know, it's, what did he call it? It was like a nonfiction novel.
Right.
And that's why I don't like In Cold Blood, because it's like,
yeah,
he makes shit up. Yeah. He's like, oh, and she thought this, and then this guy, and like, you don't know
Truman.
That. Like, it used to be, I mean, you used to have to really sugarcoat whatever true thing. Like, you had to really, you know, wrap it in a treat for people to swallow any sort of like hard investigative stuff, which is kind of disappointing, because I actually really like it when they tell a true story well without cheating, you know. And I think Thin Blue Line does a really good job writing that line. That's why I like a lot of that stuff when I say, like, it seems too much when you're first watching it. But he doesn't really cheat. Like, he does recreations, but it's not, he doesn't overdo it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this was like the first documentary to have reenactments and stuff. And apparently, from what I read, was the reason it wasn't up for Best Picture, Best Documentary in the Academy Awards, is like the Academy voters left halfway through because of the reenactments. They were like, no way. Mm-hmm. We can't have people acting, you know?
That's actually, I mean, there's a history of the Academy being terrible at judging documentaries, which is, I think it's because of how they do it, where they like sit them in a room and like, after a few minutes, like they can vote to turn it off or something, so they don't get through a lot of the really good ones.
Awesome.
And so
why sit through it?
Yeah,
I think you, me, and George should be the Academy voters for documentaries. Yeah. Well, so and you know, Errol is also joined by Philip Glass, who makes the soundtrack for this, which is like the classic Errol Morris shit, man. Like, how do you make your like he came onto this method so long ago and still uses it, and it's still so effective, like how Errol makes his documentaries with the soundtrack and stuff. But this Philip Glass shit, that shit's haunting. Like, that soundtrack is awesome.
I mean, the soundtrack's like the movie too, where it's like borderline too much, where it's like so dramatic, you know, where you like you put this music over a guy going to Taco Bell, and suddenly it's like a murder mystery.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, he leads you a lot. I mean, he leads you into things by how he shoots it, what he decides to use, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But like, that's what I love about him. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a pure documentary nerd. I like entertainment. I like documentaries that are fun to watch. So like, Errol's always doing that shit. But like, man, let's get into like Randall. My boy Randall Adams. And I, you know,
Randy.
It's like Randy, like for what? Like, you just couldn't be a hitchhiker in the 70s without some stigma, man. Like, that was just not.
I think it's funny that we don't call people drifters anymore.
No, they don't.
Like, oh, he's a drifter. I'm like, what does that mean exactly?
And, yeah. And at one point, they say the judge was like, well, it's a matter. He's just a drifter. You know, yeah. Like, it's like, why was that such a bad thing? I don't understand.
God does not paint a kind picture of Texas at all, does it?
No. No. No documentary does.
Yeah.
I don't think there is a kind Texas documentary.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there needs to be one.
Like the really sweaty cop where that one guy is just pouring sweat. Oh, man.
The cops don't come off looking very good in this one either. Yeah. They're all kind of like good old boys, mm-hmm. like, I think mm-hmm. I'm going to put you in a trunk.
It was so ridiculous because it's like they're so punitive, but then simultaneously so completely inept. Like, how did they come to the idea that Randall had killed the guy and not the most obvious choice? Like, Occam's Razor says, oh, yeah, the kid who is like been on a multi-state crime right. spree for like the last month
right.
in driving a stolen car.
Yeah.
That maybe he might be the one who killed the cop.
But he's their chief fucking witness instead. Yeah, yeah. Instead, they make him their chief witness in the entire trial.
That is insane. Yeah.
And then apparently he had done a bunch of bullshit in California where they're like, yeah, we're going to make that go too.
Mm-hmm.
Because like apparently by I love Edith
David
James.
Harris, yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, Edith James is talking about, and I loved her. She's one of the defense attorneys in this, and she's basically saying, like, he was 16, so they couldn't convict him. They mm-hmm. just wanted someone they could convict for this because the cop got killed, so they were just going to throw anybody under the bus. And, you know, and Randy Adams there was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
That was I just wanted to know. Like, you get wrapped up in the case, which is great, but you also just want to know about the night that they had. Like, this guy picks up this 16-year-old kid picks up Randy, the hitchhiker, and they go, like, smoke some pot, and they drink beers, and they go watch, like, a nudie movie at the drive-in together. What a life.
Not a nudie, but swinging cheerleaders.
Swinging cheerleaders.
I mean, that must have been pretty nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually wrote that down. I was like, I need to look that up.
Yeah. But my thing is, he wasn't even hitchhiking. He ran out of gas.
Yeah, right.
Like, he had hitchhiked to get to Texas, but then he got a job. This guy moved, got a job, ran out of gas because there was no gas stations open on Thanksgiving weekend. Like, come on, Texas. Get your shit together. People need gas. So he was just looking for some help. So, like, and then he, you know, it's one of those things where got in with the wrong guy, but you're right. It's like, you meet some guys like, hey, can you help me get gas? Sure. You want to smoke some weed, drink some beer, and go see a nudie film?
Yeah
of course.
Just drifting. I'm just drifting. It's all I'm doing is drifting.
It doesn't seem like that long ago, but God, the 70s seems so innocent and freewheeling compared to now. Like, you just pick up a hitchhiker. Hey, bro, you want to go see a movie? Oh, sure. Hey, I just got you a job. I could probably talk to – like, he got the guy a job – or he was going to get the guy a job. And they went and they saw a movie together and everything. It was just like a bunch of good old boys having a good old time.
Yeah. Yep, and then went back to his motel, and then that's where things took a turn for the worse. But we'll get to that because should we tell? I mean, people should know by now.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really spoil.
Came out in 30 years ago.
I can't really spoil this anymore. But so we have David Ray Harris, Randall Dale Adams. You can't write these names. These names are awesome. But yeah, David Ray Harris, who was 16 at the time, and from Vader. Texas, from Vader, Texas, and just in all kinds of trouble,
and bragging about killing a cop,
and then bragging to his friends like, Robert Wood was the cop who, and then here's the other. Okay, so one thing I would like to have known more about was this female police officer who they don't name.
She really bungled.
No, they do.
What's that?
Yeah, they name her. It's Teresa Tuco.
Oh, okay. I don't remember
the partner.
Yeah, the partner.
What happened to her? Do we get
she
an
did
update?
Not get interviewed though. She did not get interviewed in the movie.
No, but she was drinking a malt, and she may or may not have been in the car.
Yeah,
or may or may not have seen everything.
I mean, there's not a thing that she did right that entire time. Like she stayed in the car while her officer went out, and then she was drinking a milkshake, and then she didn't hit the car at all with their gun.
No.
Didn't remember the license plate.
No.
Didn't remember the type of car. Didn't remember how many people were in the car.
Right. She could not describe the driver.
Like, was she drunk? What the hell?
She might have been drunk. But I could also see where Robert Wood, the cop who was driving, was like, listen, I'm just going to go tell them to turn their headlights on. Right. You can stay here and finish your malted.
Yeah.
And then, oopsie-daisers. And then she, you know, maybe she might not even been looking up. It probably was a routine fucking stop kind of thing. And but unfortunately, Robert Wood is killed, and this is when all the problems happen.
Yeah.
And so they don't know who did it. So they don't know what's going on. They're looking for a car, a blue Vega. And as it turns out, it's the wrong kind of car. But for a month, they're trying to figure out what's going on. And they finally get word up from people that David Ray Harris is shooting his mouth off about something, shooting people in Vidor, Texas. So that's what kind of leads to this thing. And then as Errol expertly displays is like this evidence that just keeps ballooning and ballooning, and talking to some of these wacky fucking witnesses who, like, if we can talk about Emily Miller for a second, she's a dream, huh?
Yeah. Oh, when her husband is talking about her, and he's like, her husband is telling a story about how she called the cops on him for smuggling drugs that he didn't have, and he's like, she's a hoe, but he calls her a hoe, but I forget the exact quote. He's like, she's a hoe, but man, she'll call the cops on you, that's for sure.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Don't do anything wrong. She'll call the cops. Well, she apparently wants to be a detective, I guess.
Man.
Because she talks about, and that's one of my favorite moments in this doc is when she talks about wanting, she's like, I always want to be a detective, and I used to watch the Boston Blackie. Or whatever. Yeah, that's pretty fucking nuts.
I mean, everybody in this movie sort of contains multitudes where you're like, you want to see a movie about every single character. You're like, what is going on in that person's life?
Yeah.
What is going on in that person's life? The judge? What?
What the fuck is up with that judge?
That guy was an idiot.
He's a complete idiot. Yeah. Why are all these like true crime, get him out of prison shit always have to do with idiot prosecutors and judges?
Oh,
I loved what you said, punitive and inept or whatever. Yeah. That line is perfect for this.
Well, the judge was like, I can figure out why people do heroin and people rob banks, but for the life of me, I can't figure out why someone would kill a cop. It's like, you couldn't figure out why someone would kill a cop who's driving a stolen car? Like,
yeah.
Maybe you should understand motive if you're a goddamn judge. Like, how fucking dumb are you?
Dude, and judges are, you know, they're elected, so they don't have to earn their way to that spot. But yeah.
Painful.
It is painful. And then, like, when you find out that, like, the cops, the detectives basically believe David for some odd reason.
Yeah, because he said he originally bragged about killing the cop and admitted to it, and then he said, oh, no, I was just bragging, guys, but I was there. And then they believed him. Yeah. Like, what?
They're like, that rings true.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
that holds water.
That makes sense.
Yeah, they just really wanted this Randall guy to go to jail so they could solve this whole thing. And then, so now we get introduced to Edith James, which is one of the defense lawyers, who I love this woman. I thought she was great. And then Dennis White, the other defense attorney, who then they talk about having to go to Vidor, Texas, which is apparently like a KKK beehive, you know, like.
Yeah, that was the part that I couldn't figure out where I was like, is David Lee Harris connected to the Klan somehow and they're protecting him? Like, what is happening? Because, I mean, usually they would, I couldn't figure out what side the Klan would take on this.
Yeah. Well, I think they mentioned that they thought the cop was black.
Yeah. So, like, wouldn't they be?
But so
happy
they'd want
about the guy.
Well, they would want to hide that guy, the guy that killed a black cop.
Oh.
Because he's black. So right. Even if he's a cop, that's bad.
Right.
I guess. I mean, I think that was the implication, was that they had to go into enemy territory as like Eastern liberal smarty pants. And go into Vidor and try to get this guy out or something.
See, like, I didn't quite understand that, because I was thinking that if they thought that Randall killed the cop, killed the black cop, wouldn't they celebrate that? So why would they be against the lawyers trying to get him off? But I guess if they knew that the kid killed the black cop and they didn't want him to go down, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess.
Convoluted.
Yeah, that was. It is kind of a strange point in this, because we don't hear much from Dennis White, and there's for a while I was kind of confused even to who he is. But one of the things I do love, like Edith was saying, is like the film is like a catalyst for change, which I think is pretty awesome. But they start talking about like how David's testimony is like 2 hours off from everything, and it's like, God, this guy can't even get that shit straight. Like, and then he's basically in his testimony was like, you know, I just listened to the cops. They were like, yeah, you had popcorn at 12:30. And he's like, yeah, I had popcorn at 12:30. I was like, oh, Jesus, this guy's in it. This guy's in it bad. But there's so Errol talks about how this came about is that he was wanting to do a documentary on James Gibson, who's a psychotherapist. They call Dr. Death.
Yeah, that guy.
That fucking guy. Now, I don't know if he ever... Do you guys know, did he ever make that documentary?
I don't know.
I think it turned into this, is basically what happened, right?
Yeah, because that would be something else to watch a documentary on this guy.
I mean, that guy's completely out of his mind, right? Like, that guy's got to be almost as much of a sociopath as,
right,
as Miller.
Exactly. Yeah, and the thing about it is, like, so apparently this guy would be called in by the prosecution and he would sit with people for 15 to 20 minutes. And then afterwards he would say they're a sociopath. If they're ever let go, they'll commit heinous murders forever. Mm-hmm. And he did that for everybody. There wasn't any defendant that he didn't say wasn't a sociopath, up to like 160, I guess.
Yeah.
And there, all these people were put to death. And he did the same for Randall Adams. Mm-hmm. And so while Errol is interviewing Dr. Death, he also then talks to Randall Adams, who's conveniently the guy that he's talking to at the time. And he was like, man, you sound innocent. Not only do you not sound like a psychopath, but you actually sound innocent.
Yeah.
And then he was like, hey, can I talk to David Harris? And he talks to him and he's like, oh, shit. Like, this guy did it. And Adams.
Like, if they had put David Harris away earlier, David Harris committed a bunch of other crimes that while Randall was in jail, basically.
Yeah.
And so he would have prevented those things. I think this is also like a good example of getting people to change their mind about the death penalty if they were pro death penalty at some point. Be like, let's just see how many times this has happened. Like this 106 Dr. Death guy, and just clearly you can watch this and be like, yeah, we should at least mitigate the death penalty. There's just too much error.
I mean, the more you pay attention to court cases, like, the less you would trust them with any sort of,
dude,
really, like, you know, there's no way I would trust them with the death penalty. It's basically like a focus group.
Yeah.
And I mean, and they're just as accurate, which is not right at all.
Well, and there's people who want power and money and prestige, and those are usually prosecutors, and the way to maintain that is to make sure that you have a 100% conviction rate so that you can get reelected. You know, it's so disgusting that this is so, like, people's lives are in. And he even says that the prosecutor looked at him and said, like, I'm going to tell you how you're going to die. You're going to be in that chair. Your eyes are going to pop out. Your fingernails are going to fall. And, and Adams is like, fuck, I didn't do anything but drink a couple buds and smoke some weed and watch Swinging Cheerleaders. You know, like, maybe, I mean, one of those Swinging Cheerleaders, that might be death penalty. But the other ones, come on.
Well, watching it with a 16-year-old maybe would be an issue.
Yeah, that was a little weird. The whole time I was like, are they on a date? Like, what was happening there? Like, was this a cruisy kind of situation?
Because it kind of seemed like it's Grindr, 1976 Grindr, yeah.
Right, because I don't know, maybe the 70s was just a swinging time, but like when I'm watching it with 2017 eyes, I'm like, oh, yeah, they were like two guys that were going to go meet and go fuck. Like,
yeah, maybe. Yeah. But his brother
mustache,
was back at the hotel.
The handlebar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what drifters did in the 70s. They swung and they hatchet people. They would put a hatchet in heads.
I mean,
oldest drifter? Like, who has lived the longest as a drifter? Do you just end up in a box somewhere?
Nick Nolte.
I think Nick Nolte. Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of Nick Nolte, one thing we like to do is cast docs.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, like, who... We were talking about this earlier, so I know you need maybe a couple seconds to think about. But who would, in the movie version of Thin Blue Line, who would play whom in this? Now, I think Matthew McConaughey for Randall Adams.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What's the True Detective type?
Yeah, I could see that. I could see Sam Rockwell. He's kind of that like twitchy, like scruffy weirdo kind of thing going on.
As Adams?
Yeah. I could see him as either one. Like, he'd have to play an older David Lee Harris.
Right.
I don't know if he's as good as the sociopath. I feel like he's better as like the good-hearted, scruffy dude, Randall.
Yeah.
I think this game is you can pick anyone living or dead from whatever period of their career.
Okay.
So like, a lot of roles. I'd say young Nick Nolte actually is a good call for Randall. I hadn't thought of that one.
I like that would be great. And I was thinking Roseanne Barr for Edith James, the lawyer.
Yeah, that would be good. The lawyer. Or Kathy Bates.
Kathy Bates would be good for everything too. Yeah, she is good for everything.
That's true.
What's weird is they kind of did have to cast people that looked like Randall Adams and Teresa Tuco and Robert Wood. Mm-hmm. Like Errol Morris had to cast people. So he's kind of gone through this process, at least without famous people, I guess. The only other person I could think of that I thought I had a good actor for, one of the Texas cops, the guy with the thick red glasses. I wanted to say he, mid-period Charles Durning.
Which guy was that? The...
He was like one of the dudes. I didn't get his name, but he's one of the Texas cops that had like kind of reddish thick glasses. Mm-hmm. And you know Charles Durning, like he's a bad guy in the Muppet movie.
Oh yeah,
which one's Charles? Yeah, I can't.
He's the heavier set fella.
Okay. Heavier, just like you can picture him as a Southern cop, pretty much. That's like his whole vibe.
I think he's played a Southern cop in something. He must have.
Maybe him or Carol O'Connor. They're kind of interchangeable. Yeah.
Carol O'Connor.
Yeah, David Harris, I was trying to think. I almost want to say like young Axl Rose.
Oh, yeah.
Could do David Harris.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he did give me a weird like Axl Rose sense that whole time. I don't know. They got that weird sociopath thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, and like, it's so funny that fucking James Gibson, the god of sociopaths, Dr. Death, would mm-hmm. say that Adams is, without 100% accuracy, he's a sociopath after drawing some squiggly lines and shit. But he also was talking to David Harris, who he deemed not a sociopath.
Who's like the world's most textbook sociopath.
Yeah, because he's like nice and friendly and like people like him, but he'll just kill you.
Right.
And like, so basically what we find out, is that... Sorry, I almost knocked off my mixer. Is that David Harris does end up killing somebody that they know exactly who it is because he was broke into a man's house, put the guy in the bathtub, and then tried to steal his girlfriend. And the dude grabbed a revolver and came after him.
But that was a little weird because, I mean, like that was arguably, well, except for the stealing the girlfriend part, but the other guy might have shot at him first. It might have been like some semi... self-defense. You could probably argue self-defense in some way if it wasn't in the process of a kidnapping, but
right. I think that does set up a context. Yeah.
Right. But he didn't just, I mean, he just broke in and killed the guy for no reason. Like he kind of,
he was stealing his girlfriend. Yeah. And then he was blaming the dude. Like there's that one cop that seems to kind of like him. Mm-hmm. But it was like, hey, but you're killing people. You need to go to jail. But he's kind of a friendly guy. But he was like, David was upset that he was getting shot at. He was like calling the guy weird. It's like, that guy's crazy. He was shooting at me.
Victim blaming. For sure.
Blame the victim. Absolutely. Yeah, he seems fucking nuts. And then like, so I read up a bunch about Mr. Harrison. Apparently before he was slated for execution. Then he got a stay because he was like, this is cruel and unusual, and that didn't happen. So he was executed, but his last words were, let it roll.
Right, yeah.
Which is like, oh my God.
It's Roll Tide.
Yeah, he was a fucking douche bro from way back.
He was saying, let's roll like the guy on 9/11 guy. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was 2004. That's right.
Yeah, so that was still, executed. Let's roll. It's like, oh, cool. Jesus, you're too much.
Mark Wahlberg could have stopped his execution, is what it's really saying.
Yeah, he would be good in this movie, too.
Mm.
If it was taken from the perspective, he could play Errol Morris if it was like from like that POV.
I could see young Mark Wahlberg as David Harris, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. I probably would see that. Actually, yeah. I would probably watch that, which is sad.
I want to hear more about your idea of Mark Wahlberg as Errol Morris. That's like doing the interviews.
Listen, tell me how you. He's always out of breath.
He's always. What are you?
You can understand why a man might steal if he needs money to put food on the table. I can understand why a 17-year-old boy who doesn't have a car would steal one to ride around in. I can understand why the heroin addict needs heroin. But it's very hard to understand why anybody has to kill a police officer. It just doesn't have to be.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Here's something for those Sup Doc listeners out there, our fans, is that the thin blue line is in our logo.
Oh,
so we put a thin blue line in our logo, which is pretty sweet. Huh, George?
Well, I guess so. I was just actually reading. Well, because I was like looking at up Thin Blue Line in general. If you just Google Thin Blue Line, you just get all these like Blue Lives Matter memes. Which is just like cop.
Oh, yeah.
It's just like a phrase that it's like cops don't know about this movie, or they just think Thin Blue Line means like, yeah, we're keeping society together. It's like, no, it's also this movie is about how you guys just railroaded a guy into death row.
Because he was old. And the guy who did it was young.
Yeah,
and probably liked the younger guy.
The judge teared up when the prosecutor referenced the thin blue line in his closing statement.
I'll be honest, I did tear up a bit.
Right.
It's like, oh my god, yeah. If Errol Morris hadn't been around, fucking Adams would be dead by now.
Yeah.
Instead,
well, he's dead now for sure.
Now dead, and then my favorite part of this, he sued Errol Morris after this film came out, which is.
Well, he also, because he was never, the conviction was never officially overturned. It was just like they declined to prosecute. So he was supposed to.
Wait, what?
Like if it had been overturned, he would have been eligible to get like $80,000 from the state of Texas in damages.
Yeah.
But because it just wasn't prosecuted, he wasn't eligible. So he got zero from the state of Texas.
No way. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Because
it wasn't overturned, yeah.
So in what way was it thrown out?
It wasn't ever... you mean what way was the case thrown out? It was I don't know the details, but because of the details of how it got overturned, like he wasn't eligible for money.
Jesus Christ, I didn't know that. So he was... Oh, I see. So he was like, I want
had
part...
appeals, yeah.
Part of the film...
Well... they all have a different take on it, but what Randall said was that he just wanted his life rights. It wasn't about money because he'd given Errol Morris his life rights and he wanted them back.
This kind of ties into the thing about the Oscars, though, because basically the issue was, is Thin Blue Line considered a feature film, like a fictional feature film or a documentary? Like, it's a documentary, but because there's all these reenactments, they were sort of like, it was questionable whether it was gonna, it made some money for a documentary. It made a lot of money in 1988. But the question is whether then Randall had the rights to make like a Law and Order version or whatever, and he would have gotten paid for that. But no one wanted to do that because basically you're not going to top this movie.
Right.
You're not going to top his life story at Thin Blue Line. So he did I think he got the rights back. Errol Morris still, I guess, had a lot of debts from making this movie. But that was like what that, they settled is what ended up happening. So there's a settlement.
He got his life rights back. But it's weird. It's like usually it doesn't take much to convince people in Hollywood to repeat themselves and try to wring money out of the same property. But for some reason, in this case, they didn't. Yeah. It didn't happen.
It's weird that a documentary filmmaker would lose money on a film. That's never happened
shocking,
before.
Shocking, right?
So then we get near the end of this, which is, you know, basically Errol unfolds all this evidence, and we hear from all these bizarre witnesses and lawyers and judges and cops and stuff, and it's kind of like we're in a taqueria.
it feels like we're discussing it over tacos. Exactly.
I don't know if you guys won't be able to hear the Mexican music we hear in our headphones, but
I
it's
hope
awesome.
Not.
but I don't know if we can pay for those. But so then we get to there's an illusion at one point where one of the detectives who kind of likes him, but you can tell this guy plays by the law, says that David Harris feels better once he admits to something. Like, he admits and then he's better off with his home life and all that shit, which was kind of like this like foreshadowing for the end. Mm-hmm. Do you want to walk us through the end, Vince?
Actually, I didn't watch the last 20 minutes before I came over here.
So, let me do it.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've seen it before, yeah. But I didn't finish rewatching it today.
So in the end, it's basically we find out that there'd already been another murder, that David Harris killed someone, and that's what he's on death row for that. So when Errol Morris is talking to him, it's mostly like, hey, what you see is a tape recorder on a desk by itself. Classic Errol Morris shot. It's really cool. It's a really nice shot. And then he's talking to David Harris, and he's saying to him like, wouldn't it be awful if this guy was innocent? And he's like, yeah, it would be, because he is. And he's like, well, what do you mean he's innocent? And he's like, well, like, you know, he just happened to be at the wrong place the wrong time. And he's like, well, does that mean that you did it? And he's like, well, it doesn't mean I did it, but because criminals lie. But, you know, if someone had given me a place to stay that night at this a motel, then someone wouldn't be in this position that they're in. And then he's like, right. And so then Errol Morris is like, so wait, are you saying he's innocent? And he's like, well, yes. And then he's like, well, how do you know? And he's like, because I'm the only one that would know. And that's basically how the film ends. Yeah. And it's just like, well, fuck, dude. Like, so.
And then it's like, is that what it took to get, like, if he hadn't just come out and admitted it, would Randall have gotten off?
Yes. I mean, well, who knows? Because maybe the cops would have been like, don't say that, because we got our guy. And but instead, this guy shot somebody and was on death row for that, not for this thing.
But I mean, like, so much had to happen. Like, it was so obvious who killed the cop, and they still took him, you know, 12 years to let this guy out of prison for it.
Yeah.
Like, if David Harris hadn't come out and said it, would they have fixed it?
No.
Yeah.
No, they wouldn't have. And, like, I did read this one thing that was kind of interesting. A journalist asked later on, many years later, asked Errol Morris, like, don't you feel bad that, you know, you were sitting there with this information and you're editing this film for a year and letting guy was just in jail for that year? You know, you're making this art house film and, you know, you're all your fancy editing and shit. And, like, you had this information, but you had to wait till you put the film out.
Yeah, but, like, the information was already out there and no one did shit. So he's probably like, well, I got to construct this. Yeah. I got to make a watertight case with this movie, you know? Mm-hmm.
I guess he did say it kind of haunted him for a while that, like, you know, he wanted to finish editing. And I'm sure, like, working with Philip Glass, you know, over the overtures and while Philip is drinking his tea, maybe his chamomile. Yeah. He seems like a mint tea guy. Very herbal. Have you ever known anyone that was wrongly convicted or charged of anything?
Been wrongly convicted?
Or just like an accusation where people are like, you did it, Vince. And then you're like, I didn't do it.
No,
that's good,
thank God.
That's good. Yeah, that would be bad.
Knock on wood.
What about you, George?
So far, no.
No.
Okay. I want to say, I have a joke about this, which is like, if I am, just get someone who has Philip Glass's phone number to be my defense attorney. So I'm going to just need that playing, piping through the PA of the courtroom the whole time.
That's in your act?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's funny. That's good. Good job.
We always come out of
thank
these.
Thank you. I like comedy responses that are just thank you. That's good.
What I wonder is, like, we always come out of these things like really loving the defense attorney because obviously, right. like, they're our stand-in. They're sort of screaming truth right. To like people that won't listen. But what I always wonder is, like, did what's her name, Edith?
Edith James.
Like, Edith James, did she do a bad job? Did, like, Dean Butler and Jerry Strang in Making a Murderer, like, did they actually do a bad job? Like, if they were better, shouldn't they have been able to get the person off when there's, like, this mountain of evidence for it? I don't know. Like,
I feel like we know the answer to this, which is juries are stupid. Like, right. America's stupid, basically, is what it comes down to. It's like, this is the jury system doesn't work because your peers are dumb.
Right, that's but basically, do you need it? Like, instead of going for this lawyer, we're like, oh, Edith, she seems like such a nice person, or Jerry's like, do you need, like, a piece of shit like Johnny Cochran do you need a really cheesy huckster to really influence a jury? Is that the person that you need on your side?
Sometimes,
apparently,
I guess,
yeah.
You also need HBO and Netflix, apparently, too.
Right, yeah, well, yeah.
Because, like, you need, like, that's, like, we've talked about this previously, but, like, now it's up to entertainment to exonerate people.
I know.
It's just like, dude, if I ever get fucking arrested for something I didn't do, I'm calling a documentary filmmaker, like, immediately. You get one phone call, and I'm calling fucking Morgan Spurlock. Mm-hmm.
You know? This is, like, in my act, too. It's, like, it's called Amazon Prime Suspect. Like, you need Amazon Prime to exonerate you.
That's good. That's a good one, too.
I mean, I've been watching so many of these things. Actually, like, the thing is, like, I don't love true crime as a genre, necessarily. But, like, this one is, like, just such an interesting... This one kind of defies a lot of categories, which is why I think it's still talked about in this way.
And it started... I mean, anything that, like, is the catalyst in the beginning, you know, it's, like, it started the whole true crime genre. And what a way to start it with, like... A documentary that exonerates somebody, you know, because he basically gets a confession at the end, which is insane.
Yeah. And it's such a slice of Texas life in the 70s. I mean, this is like the flip side of Dazed and Confused, kind of like you're watching it and you're like, oh, man, it was really good time to be alive in some ways. But then in other ways, like, no, not that great.
No. Yeah. It's not all right. All right. All right.
Yeah. I like that old, I forget whose bit it was. They're talking about George W. Bush getting a DUI in Texas in 1972. He's like, you know how fucking drunk you had to be to get a DUI in Texas in 1970? Yeah. Like, you had to, like, slam into the curb and walk out and, like, fall into a hedge. Like, there's no way.
Yeah.
I think you had to crash into Patton. The cop's house.
Yeah. It's either Patton or David Cross. I'm trying to remember which one it is, but I think I've heard that on one of those. Yeah.
That's funny.
But that's true. I mean, like, if you are his dad was famous at that point. Yeah. Like, he was
CIA
a rich
director.
White kid in Texas. Like, how bad did you have to be drinking and driving to actually get charged with a DUI?
Just swamped drunk. Yeah. You know, the cop was probably like, I don't want to take you and swing. Like, listen, George, really don't want to just punch. Like, ugh.
Give him my gun back, George.
Stop it, George. Get down from that water tower.
I want to see the Errol Morris Bush movie. It's sort of like The Fog of War, but just like the drunkness. Yeah, the cocaine-fueled.
I mean,
yeah.
That would make a really good movie at this point, like, now that he's transitioned into this weird third phase
artist.
Of his career where he's, like, painting dogs and shit.
He's
so like a reverse James Franco or something, yeah.
Yeah.
He is Benjamin Button's Franco.
I got a question for you guys, which is, let's say you got to pick one screen cap from this movie because the visuals are so good. In this movie,
he's so great at it.
What would be your screen cap if, like, you know, we're promoting this episode? Like, what's your screen cap from Thin Blue Line?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think for me, it might be Emily Miller, the blonde, the fake blonde.
I was going to say she's
makeup.
She's my favorite, like, image, but I feel like she's too tangential to the plot somehow.
Yeah, she is. Yeah. For something that I mean, it'd have to be probably like that little faraway shot.
GIF. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, maybe like an animated GIF, if not a screen cap.
Oh,
just like
right.
2 second something motion thing.
I can't believe you're a GIF guy.
I'm trying to do what people tell me. I
no,
believe it's a soft
gift.
G.
It's all no.
Look,
I
my name is George, so I have to go with yeah, a soft
fair.
G.
That's fair.
Or maybe the diagram of the shooting crime.
Oh
scene,
yeah, that's it, very
it
good.
Has, yeah, it has the good. Squiggly line that represents the chocolate shake, the Burger King. Mm-hmm. The other mm-hmm. thing that I thought was hilarious was Emily was talking about being at a restaurant when she was talking about Burger King.
Uh-huh.
It's like, oh, man, that must be the 70s. Yeah, right. When they're referring to Burger King
70s
as a restaurant.
Burger King was better. I think yeah. Burger King was so, better in the 70s. It was more respected in the 70s.
Yeah, definitely.
So they were all connected
the
by
Burger King,
The monarchy
of burgers.
Right?
All connected to Burger King.
Because yeah. the cop had the shake. She just yep. went to Burger King.
Yep.
I'm assuming they probably caught the... David Harris coming out of the Burger King with no
imagine.
Lights on.
Yeah.
And then the witnesses all were coming out of Burger yeah. King.
Except for my man in the Cadillac.
Yeah, what was
he
going
was
on with that guy?
He was just taking a side piece home. Like, he was talking about how he had his wife, he had a wife, but she would be pissed off if he knew he was hanging out with this girl.
Yeah, you know right. who would play that guy?
Who? Craig what's, Robinson?
No, what's the guy from Coming to America who plays the boyfriend? His name's like Eric something. The guy who plays... Her boyfriend, like the rich asshole boyfriend?
Not Arsenio Hall.
It's like Eric something.
I gotta say, I've never seen Coming to America.
Hold on. Oh, what?
Wow.
Yeah. I have a lot of gaps.
I've seen that movie like thousands of times.
I like Beverly Hills Cop. I will have to like check out Coming to America because...
I mean, I don't necessarily say it because it's great. I'm looking for him. Hold on. I got IMDb. I hate the old... layout. On my computer, I changed. Oh, Eric LaSalle.
Oh, Eric LaSalle.
Oh, Eric. Yeah, ER. The guy from ER.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Like
yeah.
In like, look, Eric. Look up Eric LaSalle in Coming to America. He looks just like that dude. Like same hair and mustache.
Just that weird sweater.
That cool like mini fro, like that tight yeah. like mini fro
oh, yeah.
thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was. I mean, and he's the guy that says like, "I have a photographic memory. I'm a salesman. I can remember yeah. names, places." And what was that car? It was blue. It was like a Ford.
It was definitely blue.
It was definitely blue. I think
it was a blue something.
And then I think they walked up. Right. He walked up to the car. It's like, oh, Errol. That's what I mean about his sense of humor. I'm just like, God yeah. damn it. It's
yeah.
awesome.
I mean,
just
let
people
hang
talk.
Themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally.
Absolutely. But so yeah. So then we find out. That they're all in prison, and that eventually Adams gets let go. And what is pretty fascinating, it was like right as this film was released, they're like, "Oops, mm-hmm. let him out," you know. So I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, they started petitions and stuff. And this is like this wasn't in that many theaters; it was only like in 100 theaters. But
oh god,
people
I didn't
petitions.
Think about that.
Mm. Yeah,
like, this isn't like today where
pre-internet.
It's all over the fucking place.
No, but no. I mean, documentaries still aren't like it's still yeah. like you're not gonna go down to the multiplex and see a documentary.
No, you yeah, it's usually that some 5-star Embarcadero kind of small.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I mean, if it's on Netflix or Amazon, if you're lucky, or HBO, but otherwise,
right.
you're
thank
not
God
seeing
for
it.
Netflix, man.
Well, like
unfortunately, we are at our end, but thank you so much for coming on and talking yeah. about this.
Sorry if
us.
I talk too much.
Yeah. No.
I'm verbose.
No.
This
no,
is what it's about. This is a podcast. It's
perfectly lovely. Perfectly lovely.
And we got to talk about Papa Roach and murder, so it's all yeah. good.
Is there anything you want to promote? Anything that's coming up?
Just Film Drunk, Twitter at Film Drunk or filmdrunk.com. And my podcast is the Film Drunk Frotcast. That's FROT, Frotcast. It's a comedy podcast that's about movies. Check
awesome.
It out.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on and bringing up Thin Blue Line. We love it.
Yeah, thank you.
And this will
yeah,
be, this is part of our mayhem, fucking SupDoc Mayhem Month. So, true crime, bitches.
Hey, thanks for listening.
You can find more episodes of SupDoc, show notes, updates, and more at supdocpodcast.com.
We're also on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at supdocpodcast.
And you can also email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com if you have show notes, corrections, or if you want to hear us talk about a specific documentary.
We also appreciate anyone who can donate to our Patreon. Check out patreon.com/supdocpodcast.
And if you can't donate financially, please just like and subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you find podcasts.
Thanks also to Documentary News for their ongoing support of the show.
Yeah, and the show is produced by Will Scovel.
Our theme music is by David Siegel, and this special Mayhem remix is by listener Kevin Colson.